We're going to go ahead and get started with the final panel of the symposium. We're going out with a bang, talking about always timely issues about executive power. So welcome to the final panel. It's entitled Modern Debates, Old Insights, The Federalists, Anti-Federalists, and Executive Power. I have the great pleasure of introducing the moderator for this panel, Judge Paul Mady. Judge Mady serves on the United States Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit. Before his appointment to the bench in 2019, he was a partner in the New Jersey office of Lowenstein Sandler. Earlier, Judge Mady was a senior vice president, general counsel, and secretary for University Hospital Newark, an academic medical center and teaching hospital. He also served as the deputy chief counsel to Governor Chris Christie and as an AUSA for the District of New Jersey, where he was awarded the Justice Department's Director's Award for Superior Performance. Judge Mady also spent a few years at Kellogg Hansen in Washington, D.C., and himself clerked for judges on the District of New Jersey and the Third Circuit. He's a graduate of the University of Scranton and Seton Hall University School of Law. Judge Mady, we're honored to have you here along with the rest of our distinguished panelists. I'll pass it on to you.
Thank you so much for that kind introduction. Is this on?
It doesn't sound like it.
I don't think the mic's on. There we go. Is that better? No. This is going to force me to yell in that judicial voice. Nope. I like it. I have been directed to keep going, so keep going. I shall. Thank you for that kind introduction. I'm delighted to join so many old friends and so many future leaders at this important conference. Even if we are here to talk about a topic that is not new and is not complicated. I mean, that's at least what I was led to believe by star of stage and song, Alexander Hamilton. After all, didn't he write that there is hardly any part of the proposal of Article 2 of which could have been attended to with greater difficulty, and certainly none which has been inveighed against with less candor or criticized with less judgment? This was to be no monarch in waiting. No, he thundered. It would be difficult to determine whether the president would possess more or less power than the governor of New York. And who could possibly think a dictator would ever arise in Albany? And come to mention it, doesn't history teach us that a little classical dictatorship is essential to good government? Didn't Hamilton also tell us that the least conversant in Roman story knows how often the Republic took refuge in the absolute power of a single man, and not just against foreign enemies, but to combat those pesky, domestic, ambitious individuals who were aspiring to tyranny? A feeble executive, after all, implies a feeble execution of government. So by all means, wrote John Adams, separate the powers, but largely because, quote, people's rights and liberties can never be preserved without a strong executive. And that executive power, of course, has to be kept away from the people and their legislature. And since those views won the day, or at least the days of ratification, well, what are we here to debate? Is our current discontent about executive power pinned to the executives we've come to know? Why, in other words, did Arthur Schlesinger Jr. worry in 1973, but not 1963, that the constitutional presidency has become an imperial presidency? And is our mostly recent fretting about non-delegation, that executive limiting doctrine last seen in a 1936 curtain call, really a true return to Lockean laws of nature, or just a natural attempt to lock away legal powers from presidents on the other side of, well, whatever issue is at issue? Are we, in short, simply replaying the old home movies of Pompey and Cicero, longing for the republic that might have been if only the forefathers of federalism had not been so swayed against truly separated powers by their ancient tutors? Or have we awoken to remember the genius of the agreement that we accepted in 1788? An agreement that, as Paine would write, rallying to revolution would keep liberty safe from those always tempted to cross the river that protects the republic. Because so far as we approve of monarchy in America, the law is king, and there ought to be no other. It is, as Justice Gorsuch wrote, quoting Professor Gary Lawson, that if Congress can pass off the legislative power to the executive branch, well, then the entire structure of the Constitution would make no sense. Turns out there is much still to debate, and we are exceptionally fortunate today to have this panel to explore these questions. Like you, I am delighted to have the chance to learn from these thinkers, beginning with our first panelist, Professor Jennifer Mascott. Professor Mascott is an assistant professor of law and co-executive director of the C. Boyd and Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State at the Antonin Scalia Law School. She serves as a public member of the Administrative Conference of the United States and from 2019 to 2021 as a deputy assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Counsel. Her scholarship has appeared in journals across the country and in the opinions of the Supreme Court. She is a former law clerk to Justice Clarence Thomas and then Judge Brett Kavanaugh. Professor, welcome.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here, and appreciate you all sticking with us throughout this whole conference here to have the final substantive panel before we have our great dinner and set of receptions this evening. And I feel very honored to be up here and have the chance to talk with everybody. And so since I'm leading things off, I figured that I would start by maybe putting the discussion today in some context. Why are we talking about the executive power? What are the stakes? Why should it be important to us to examine it? So the topic of our panel is the Federalist, Anti-Federalist, and the executive power. And so we're trying to unearth what the debates were, obviously, back in the 1780s and around that time. But why is this such an important issue? And I think, you know, just from our lived experience, we can see, and speaking as a former executive branch lawyer, as was mentioned, and Professor Rappaport up here also served in the Office of Legal Counsel, which, for those of you not familiar, it is really the sort of the lawyer's lawyer, the executive power, sort of extraordinaire office in the executive branch, because the Office of Legal Counsel has been delegated the Attorney General's authority to interpret the law for the president, which was authority that the Attorney General first received in 1789 by statute. And so the office has basically sort of a body of common law that's built up over the decades, where it's charged with answering constitutional questions for the executive branch and for the president. And so if the president is wondering, do I have the constitutional power to initiate this military attack? Do I have the constitutional power to, pardon a particular person, or whatever the question might be, some real, some maybe didn't, some hypothetical, in the examples I'm mentioning, that kind of question would go to the Office of Legal Counsel. And so you can see when you're in the government and experiencing it, how appropriately in a certain sense, people who are charged with directing to the president are going to answer these questions with the president and the executive branch interest at heart. And over the decades and the centuries, of course, the executive branch has grown quite powerful. And actually, not just in the Office of Legal Counsel, but across the entire executive branch, just are reams and reams, scores and scores, hundreds and hundreds of attorneys whose job is to figure out, you know, lawfully what can the executive do with statutory authority, constitutional authority. And so as a practical matter, because I think the president commands now so many agencies, right, and he constitutionally was charged in a lot of ways with foreign affairs and national security power, which my colleagues here will talk about how much appropriately was he charged with and how much not, the office commands now quite a vast share of federal power. And so it's really important, I think, for us to think about, is that the way that it was originally designed to be? Does the executive have too much of the share of the power now? If so, is that true as a domestic matter? Is it true as a matter of international affairs? What can be done about it? And it's interesting to think through what the constitutional mechanisms might be for accountability there. Obviously, if you're a Madisonian and you've read through your Constitution and some of the Federalist Papers, which I would imagine many of us here at the Federalist Society have done, you'll see that one of the original ideas was that each each branch was going to, at the federal level, separation of powers, keep the other one in line, because each branch would presumably have institutional interests. And so what would keep the executive perhaps from getting too much of a share of the power? It would be Congress. It would maybe be the judiciary rising up and protecting its own institutional interest. And so it would be interesting to think now in the 21st century, is that model operating in the same way? Does the rise of two political parties change the alignment and the institutions? So are separation of powers between the branches working in as pure of a way as maybe some would have initially thought? Or now are folks' interests more aligned with their political parties, such that it's not actually a fight between the president and Congress, but it's the president and the members of Congress of his or her political party versus the others? And does that impact the institutional interest, and should we be concerned about it, and what do we do about it as a constitutional matter? I mean, obviously, one thing we can do if we have questions about separation of powers of the executive is try to think through whether then Congress, as a co-equal branch, is playing its proper role. There's been a lot of discussion this weekend already, you know, being skeptical that that's the case. And personally, as a former executive branch lawyer, now an ad law constitutional scholar, I also am concerned about it and study it. So we have a separation of powers in the political branch seminar, actually, that we just started at Scalia Law School this past year with one of my old executive branch colleagues, where we actually look at the congressional power, the executive power, building on a lot of the scholarship of the folks up here on the stage and others who spoke this weekend, Professor Amar, Professor McConnell, and figure out what tools does each branch have. And in my capacity at the Gray Center, we have actually just in the last few weeks opened a congressional education division where I now, in addition to teaching classes at the law school, have been going over to Congress to actually try to teach staff about separation of powers and the Constitution. And it's not really complicated. It's just the staff there aren't really lawyers. And so we just go, you know, provision by provision through the Constitution, like what can Congress actually be doing, because it's not, you know, it's not always clear that there are the same institutional tools there to be able to examine and think about those issues in the way that the executive branch, empowered with hundreds of attorneys and its own constitutional law shop in OLC, is able to do. In my academic capacity to try to get at the founding era debate, I'd be curious what folks up here have to say in response, but my scholarship has been somewhat focused on the appointments clause, looking at the electoral constraints or appointments constraints on the executive branch, and that study suggests that at least at the founding, one source of accountability was going to be accountability in selecting the president, selecting people who were going to be serving in the federal government, and the appointments clause gives the primary appointments authority, of course, to the president with Senate consent, and then there are alternative mechanisms for inferior officers. And my early research suggested that those constraints should really apply to most of the people exercising federal power in the executive branch. But the question, I guess, is were those constraints a principal constraint on accountability in the executive branch? Where does the appointments clause fit within the executive power writ large? Was the appointments clause actually a reduction in the president's power, an expansion of it? If you see the president's executive power as being in the vesting clause of Article II, which I think is really actually a core issue of debate, or perhaps some difference to varying degrees between scholars up here, maybe the appointments clause actually takes away power from the president and gives it to Congress in establishing laws, where maybe the executive power originally meant to supervise and staff the executive branch. And if it did, then the appointments clause actually reduces the president's authority quite a bit. And so if you're somebody who's concerned about presidential authority, you would actually want a very expansive meaning of the officers of the United States, because that gives Congress, through its office creation role, and the Senate through its advice and consent function, arguably a greater role in staffing the executive branch and keeping accountability in the separation of powers than it would have otherwise. So I'm trying to unpack this a little bit more academically. My most recent project, which I started first in 2018 before going into the government, and so I'm just now getting back to it, is to try to unpack this a little bit more by going through the ratification debates to see what the larger theories and discussion were about accountability. And for those of you who have studied and thought about originalist interpretation, looking at the ratification debates, there might be a lot of folks, even up here on the stage, who would say, well, gosh, that's not really great, pure originalist methodology, because it's just one source course, and you don't want to take statements from the ratification debates. And I agree with all of that. I think the ratification debates are, so this current piece is really just sort of one more bit to try to get it theoretically. What did folks at that time think was going to keep this big, vast, potentially vast or new machine of government accountable, and how was it going to be responsive to the people, and just sort of one more information source. The only reason we might care about the ratification debates is because obviously it was the state ratification conventions, right, whose votes in approving and ratifying the Constitution actually gave it its power, and so to the extent that you think that the mindset of the people who voted to make the Constitution our governing law was relevant, you would look at it. If you were an original public meaning person, obviously you think it's one of multiple sources that you should look at. And then, you know, you just have to take all of these debates and discussions, I think, in context and look at many, many different sources. And that's one reason actually why I admire and think so much of the work of everybody up here, is because I think methodologically, all of the scholars really that we've had a chance to listen to this weekend have done extensive work in original sources, reading perspectives of many different people. So before we move on, what were, at least from the ratification debates and the initial portions of them that I've looked at, mostly the Virginia debates, what were some of the things that they said about executive power? What did they say about accountability in general? And clearly, you know, so a lot of the same structural themes that we're talking about all weekend were front and center. So the first was electoral accountability. So that raises, I guess, some questions for us when we're thinking about executive power, because, of course, when the Constitution was first ratified, the president could serve for an indefinite number of terms. So if electoral accountability is key to keeping power in check, what do we do now with the 22nd Amendment where the president can only serve for two terms? And as a matter of custom, George Washington only served for two terms. So does that mean that the president and the whole executive structure is not going to have proper accountability incentives when it's no longer seeking reelection? I guess practically speaking, maybe the president could be concerned about his legacy, but does that somehow impact things? Well, I think one answer there is that when the founders were thinking about executive power and the share of the power, and they were thinking about electoral constraints, you'll see actually repeatedly in the ratification debate statements made about how the House of Representatives was going to have such a vast share of policymaking power. It's reflected in constitutional provisions such as revenue bills having to originate in the House. And the idea was that the executive would hold a comparatively little share of the piece of the pie. Now, my personal understanding from reading scholarship and reading the debates is that when the president has that power, he or she needs to be in full command of it. So if you're thinking about the executive power vertically and supervision, it's sort of complete and total. There shouldn't be anything out of the executive branch that's veering away from it, right? The vesting of all executive powers in the president. But when you're looking at the whole federal government, how much of the share of the power does he or she have? Well, at least in the policymaking stage, some of the ratification debate statements suggest really not all that much. Oh, and the other important piece that I should have mentioned is it is hard to talk about things like executive power in a vacuum. We're doing it up here, but it's really important to think about it, I think, in the context of the other structural constraint, federalism, which we heard a lot about earlier today, right? Because it's very hard to understand what's happening at the federal level and what the executive's going to do if you don't understand and keep in mind that there were going to be many, many other separate governments still doing the principal share of the policymaking at the state level. And it's like another reason why Professor Mortensen and I were actually at a conference together in the fall where we were supposed to be critiquing a book on comparative law, comparing U.S. law to other nations' laws. And there was a lot of comparison critiques being made of separation of powers or what the various branches were doing. But what was interesting is that the other systems of government to which the U.S. was being compared did not have the same federalist system of divided, you know, vertical power. And so how much does that change things? Probably quite a bit, because, again, maybe separation of powers was going to be understood to work in a system that really was a government of enumerated powers and was not doing nearly as much at the top level because of the states. And so what does that mean for us in the 21st century? So electoral accountability is going to be key. The other thing, the structural accountability, the division of power between the branches. I'll pull out one interesting quote of an early sort of description in one of the debates about what the Edmund Pendleton, the presiding officer of the Virginia Ratifying Convention, explained it as following. The legislature was going to fix rules, impose sanctions, and point out the punishment of the transgressors of these rules. An executive was going to watch over the officers, bring them to punishment. So that's it. The executive watch over the officers, bring them to punishment under domestic stage. A judiciary to guard the innocent and fix the guilty by a fair trial. So again, at least at the time, the legislature was going to really be doing the policy making. The executive was going to carry it out. And there were going to be a lot of judicial protections. And to build on one reference Professor Amar made earlier today, you can also see a lot of reference to juries in the ratification debates. And it's curious to think today is one reason why we maybe don't immediately recognize administrative power as a deviation from the constitutional norms is maybe because we aren't as highly valuing juries, which of course are not present at all in administrative adjudication. So it's going to be structural accountability, separation at the federal level. So these themes are talked about a lot, which is one reason why I think officer accountability is hard to measure what the founding era understanding of it was specifically, because it's a matter of reading like debates and theories. It's not as though there's one word or one concept in the Constitution that's going to inform us. The ratifiers thought that the federal officers were going to be subject to the laws that they enacted, that was going to be a key constraint. And so that's curious to think about today, right? Because at least with Congress, there are many laws that Congress passes that it's not subject to itself, like Freedom of Information Act laws. Madison at least thought state officers might be used to perform federal functions. Now we have the anti-commandeering doctrine. So how do those work together? And then obviously, the incompatibility clause protections. Members of Congress were not supposed to be creating offices that they were going to go fill and serve. An interesting deviation from this, one of my family members used to work on the Hill years ago, and his boss was trying for years and years and years to get a human rights or international religious freedom commission established. Couldn't get it done, couldn't get the law passed. Finally, at the very last conference stages of a huge omnibus bill, got a call from a leadership staffer that said, I was finally able to get your boss's commission created and stuck in at the very last minute to this hundreds of pages long bill. And my family member a few months later noticed that this leadership staffer then left the leadership office and ended up serving in a very important role on that commission. So the incompatibility clause did not apply to the staffer, but as a reality, they are the ones getting the bills drafted, so maybe it's not sufficiently broad, the protections. And then the final thing, individual accountability. There was, you know, we always think about impeachment, we think about removal of officers. There was a lot of discussion about common law causes of action. Tort action was the mechanism that they was at least used initially, state law tort action with federal officers. But, you know, there's discussion about, well, we can't just rely on impeachment because who's going to be able to get all the way to D.C. to be able to bring impeachment charges and to use that mechanism. So we need common law causes of action potentially. Also, what was interesting in reading through the first Congress congressional statutes, officers often had to post bond. Anybody who was going to be collecting money, like a customs officer, a revenue officer, was going to have some huge, like tens of thousands of dollars of bond that was going to be a surety that they did not engage in bad actions. And then there were also some interesting conflict of interest provisions, all put in congressional statutes. These are not just regulations and things made by other people. It's statutes, folks accountable back to the people. But so hopefully in the not too distant future, there will be a chance to plumb this a lot more. But I think there's a very, very rich sense in the founding era debates about the need for accountability in the exercise of power. There was a very real sense that it was going to be Congress doing things and not just this one person seated in the executive branch heading all of that power. And you know, hopefully we can, and the final point, it's just very interesting, or it's very important, I think, to think about, and regardless of what sides you fall down on at the end of the day, be thinking about, be revisiting the old debates and asking, where are the people who are in charge and exercising power claiming, what are they claiming as the source of that, as the source of that power, and is it being used, you know, responsibly in the best interest of the electorate?
Thank you, Professor. Next, we are joined by Professor Julian Mortensen, the James G. Phil Professor of Law at the University of Michigan. His scholarship includes articles, books, and case books on the powers of the federal government at the founding. and his academic work complements an active litigation practice in the federal and state courts. Before arriving in Michigan, Professor Mortensen worked in the President's Office of the International Criminal Tribunal, the former Yugoslavia, and he served as a law clerk for both Justice David Souter and Judge Harvey Wilkinson. Professor, welcome.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the kind introduction. It's terrific to be here. Really enjoyed hearing Professor Mascott's presentation, and looking forward to the rest as well. I've tried to pitch my comments toward the, I guess, the, you know, they say in law school, be sure you answer the call of the exam question. I thought that the structure of anti-federalist versus federalist is an interesting take on a way to sort of structure thoughts and arguments. And so what I'm going to try to do is to offer, first of all, a structure of kind of the common conceptual grammar of executive power in the late 18th century, and then sort of let you hear federalists and anti-federalists talking to one another in their own words, which I think is sometimes some of the most fun stuff about getting to do this job is being immersed in these materials, which are often colorful and wonderful. The very big picture background from which executive power debates about the US Constitution began was the broad sense of crisis that gripped the country in the 1980s, in the 1780s. 1980s were wonderful. In the 1780s, around the ineffectiveness of national government. And one of the remarkable things, to me at least, and a little bit contrary to some of my expectations when I first tackled this material going back, I don't know, 8 or 9 years, is how actually this sense was shared by what we now call the Federalists and what we now call the Anti-Federalists, in part because, of course, who the Anti-Federalists were was never anything even close to a cohesive political coalition, let alone a cohesive kind of monolithic political philosophical position. But they sort of shared the view that things were really bad in the U.S. I mean, one of the, you know, George Washington calls congressional requisitions, meaning the Continental Congress, little better than a jest and a byword throughout the land. This idea of a joke or a thing that mocks itself in the national government pervades comments from Federalists. Another Federalist author says, "How humiliating is our present situation? How necessary for the Union is a coercive principle? No man pretends the contrary." And that is getting at sort of one of the very significant policy concerns, political policy concerns, that underlay this sense of crisis was what I think of as the execution problem. Congress, and this is true both at the state level to a substantial degree, but especially at the national level, Congress can write all the laws it wanted to, but the degree to which they were followed through on was extremely questionable, and often they really were sort of a sham of the legal process. The inability to execute the laws that were formulated by the Continental Congress. What's interesting is that you get people, prominent anti-federalists like Sentinel, saying basically the same thing. The present Confederation, he says, in a persuasive mode, attempting to convey that, yes, he understands the political imperatives that are going on, gain credibility around at least extending some appreciation of what people who've written the Constitution were trying to do. The present Confederation, he says, is inadequate to the objects of the Union. But then he and many other anti-federalists like him urged that the overreaction to what was objectively a huge problem with American governance was a real threat to liberty. So it's sort of a concession of the common problem that, yes, our government needs to have a much better system of executing that which it enacts, but the anti-federalist dispute often, sometimes you get some anti-federalists denying that there's a problem at all, but often it takes the forms of federalists going on about how terrible the present situation is because there is no coercive principle in the national government. And anti-federalists saying, yeah, we know it's not so great right now, but what we're going to do is we're going to plunge headlong into the dreadful abyss of despotic government with swarms of enforcement agents. They sketch this picture of a, you know, going way overboard in response to what's a real problem. And that's kind of the terms of the debate. It was an agreement that this coercive principle, that this need for execution, was a thing that had to happen. And so that's the background. So how did they fix the execution problem? to the extent that they did. And I think it's fair to say they did. And they fix it too well, I don't know. But what did they do? The way that they thought about government power, and I'm speaking now of a grammar of conversation about political structures, than about contingent positions on what those political structures should look like, was to divide between two different ways to slice up what government does. One was subject matter competences. So like trade policy, or policy with the Native American tribes, or a policy around, you know, what the nuisance laws should be. Subject matter areas of human existence that needed to be addressed and regulated by government. Competences, and that is an ahistorical, phrase. I draw it from the EU conversation because I think it's useful for contemporary lawyers. But like subject matters, the competences of the government that spoke to things that had to be taken care of. Foreign affairs, war. And that's one kind of slice of what government does. The other slice of what government does is to talk about the functions that are allocated throughout government to perform the different phases of bringing an idea into conception and then implementing it, and specifically executing it in the world at large. And so the functional divisions of government were around the division between legislative power principally and executive power. Judicial power often gets called out all the more so once it's actually entrenched in the conversation they're debating. But it is often viewed, in an orthodox sense, as a subset of executive power. And I always love the Rousseau's summary of how this sequence of operations was thought to work, because it has this totally naive body-mind metaphor that goes against lots of what we know about modern neuroscience, but I think it's a lovely passage, and it sort of reflects how they talked about these things. He says, every free action has two causes which concur to produce it. One moral, the will which produces the act. You've got the will, the other physical, the strength which executes it. Right? So for me to raise my hand, he goes on to say, I must mean for my hand to raise, and then my muscles must raise my hand. The will and the force are kind of conceptually, on this naive account of human action, divided. He then goes on to say, the body politic has the same two motive powers, and we can make the same distinction between will and strength. The former, will, is legislative power, and the latter, strength, is executive power, the muscles that implement the order that has come from the brain, basically. And so what's interesting about this tripartite scheme of government from a powers perspective rather than from a competences perspective is that they talk about it in terms of the creation of complete or perfect government. Your government was imperfect if it didn't have all the things necessary to go from intention to making reality happen on the ground. And of course, this is one of the things that, again, both Democrats and Republicans, both anti-federalists and federalists kind of concede about the Continental Congress, that it's not a perfect government. It is an imperfect government because it doesn't contain, in particular, not the shortness of legislative competences, right? Not that there's not a commerce clause, for example. I mean, they didn't like that, the federalists didn't anyway. But to call the federal government incomplete, which they did, had to do with the failure of execution, basically. And what's really quite interesting to me about this is, again, this is actually something that they agree about descriptively now in terms of the grammar of the conversation across anti-federalist, federalist lines. So Brutus says, to give the general government complete legislative, executive, and judicial powers to every purpose would yield something frightening. One complete government possessed of perfect legislative, judicial, and executive powers. And one of the things I think is most interesting about this is they talk all the time about sub-jurisdictions, cities in particular, municipalities, as being either perfect or not perfect based on what their execution structure looked like, as opposed to the extent to which they had something like the police power over every conceivable thing that they might want to regulate. Okay, so we have this grammar. We have the executive power, the legislative power, and basically the judicial power, subset of executive power maybe, as a suite of tools or of abilities for the government to implement its substantive charges. And we have the need for a better executive principle of government, a coercive principle of government at the national level. And so what they do is they do expand legislative competencies for sure. The range of subject matter areas in the real world which may be affected as a legal matter by the promulgations in particular, although not only, of the Congress. But they also added expressly an enforcement power to operate directly on people, and that was the addition of the executive power. Now to go on 12 minutes, right? I'm trying to, okay. So how does this all cash out in terms of anti-federalists versus federalists during the debates? There's a really interesting sequence of it's a very typical way for the argument to proceed in the different states, and in the pamphleting in the different states, and in the actual ratification conventions in the different states. The problem that the Federalists started with was they had, in a very real sense, recreated, in some respects, a creature that was more powerful than the crown. And that was a really big problem, because if everybody could agree on one thing, it was that whatever we're doing, it can't be a king. It's not clear they knew what they meant by what it meant to be a king. It was sort of a, well, maybe more on that later. But, you know, I like Hamilton on this. Hamilton says, the writers against the Constitution seem to have taken pains to signalize their talents of misrepresentation, calculating upon the aversion of the people to monarchy. They have endeavored to enlist all this to attack the office of the president, not merely as the embryo, but as the full-grown progeny of that detested parent, that is to say, monarchy. We can't have a king. We need better execution. We need a more forceful central principle of governing, but it can't be a king. And, you know, Hamilton goes on. I just love this passage, so I'm going to take it a little more. He has been shown to us with the diadem sparkling on his brow and the imperial purple flowing in his train. He has been seated on a throne surrounded with minions and mistresses, despotism and voluptuousness, murdering janissaries. I mean, he's over the top. But he's responding to people like Patrick Henry, going on and on about this great and mighty president with very extensive powers, the powers of a king. Luther Martin saying the president will be a king in name as well as in substance once he decides to. All we're talking about is whether or not this office is going to be called the king or not, because it's basically a king. And the vulnerability for the Federalists on this front was that there were some really important powers the president was given that were regal in some important respects in like the 17th century, like most full-blown vision of Stuart governance sense. Sorry, one second. In particular, the ability to veto qualified fine, but the qualified negative existed in theory in England, but didn't at all really exist in England by the time that the founding is happening. The ability to make appointments, that was a hugely contested proposition in the colonies, partly because it had such high stakes for how the places these people were in were run by the agents of the English government, some really important national security authorities, the treaty power, commander-in-chief power. I mean, these things are not small, and you can build on them to say this is a king, and whatever else we want, we don't want a king. So what happens when the anti-federalists levy these kinds of charges that I've read? I'm going to give you one more response from the Federalists. They just get so annoyed at these exaggerating anti-Federalists. These are the warnings. The warnings about presidents are the same design that nurses tell children many stories about rawhead and bloody bones. And I tried to figure out what rawhead and bloody bones are, and I couldn't figure it out. But right, so this is they're mocking them, and then the conversation will pivot to, like, now let's get real. There's this moment where, like the tone of the Federalist pivot is to say, all right, back from this, you know, insane vision of, you know, the president with the diadem and whatnot, let's actually walk through the powers that the president has. And there's a contrast to how crown power works in the United Kingdom. One of the examples that I like specifically contrasts the Glorious Revolution in England to what the Constitution was meant to have done, in the following way. The Glorious Revolution addresses some important individual rights protections for the people of England. But it leaves the legal substance of the crown prerogative, the crown powers, in place. And here's the criticism from a Federalist saying how great the US Constitution is and how much we shouldn't be afraid of these like bloody raw bones or whatever. He says, had the English at this time limited the regal power in definite terms, instead of satisfying them with themselves with the Bill of Rights, there would have been an end of prerogative. But they, from habit, were contented with a Bill of Rights leaving the prerogative, that is to say the full suite of crown power, still inaccurately defined, to claim by implication the exercise of all powers that weren't specifically restricted from it, right? So you've left open for arguments from implication, you foolish English people who didn't, you know, follow through on the spirit of liberty the way that we, the true heirs of, right, the Gothic liberties are meant to have. And then the Federalists would turn to walk through the powers of the federal government, pardon me, of Article II, and list them. There just aren't that many. I mean, this is one of the like known things, textually speaking, not yet talking about the scope of the text. There just aren't that many affirmative powers given to the president. They're super important, some of them, but there aren't that many. And would say, like, compare this list to this long list of king powers under the royal prerogative. What snake in the grass is there here? The Constitution plainly, openly, and without disguise tells us the titles, officers, powers, and privileges of the various officials in government and the purposes of their appointment. What snake in the grass is there here? And they do this thing where they list the Blackstone prerogatives and then pivot to the presidential prerogatives and say, the thing speaks for itself. And that happens in lots of different conversations over the course of ratification. I've gone over, I apologize. But that's sort of the upshot. Is the anti-federalists are taking a well-known aversion to the concept of monarchy, almost an emotional, like political imaginary, the emotional culture of like we can't have a king, and are really twisting that with some real grounding in stuff like especially the veto and the appointments power to say you just made a king, and the Federalists are saying, come off it. There's like three things the president can do, but also it's really important because he fixes our execution problem. And so they couldn't deny that the president was a really important, powerful office. But the move was to try to like deflate the broadest accusations of the anti-federalists by getting very legalistic and walking through the actual legalistic terms of Article II and sort of saying, what's the problem here? This is way less than the crown has. So that's my quick summary of at least how I read the debates between the anti-federalists and the Federalists. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. How about a hometown hero next? Professor Sai Prakash is the James Monroe Distinguished Professor of Law and Paul Mahoney Research Professor of Law here at the University of Virginia, where he focuses on separation of powers, particularly the executive branch. Along with numerous law review articles, his books include The Living Presidency, an Originalist Argument Against Its Ever-Expanding Powers, and Imperial From the Beginning, the Constitution of the Original Executive. He also served as a law clerk to Judge Silberman and to Justice Thomas. Professor.
Well, thank you, Judge. The hometown homeboy wants to express his gratitude to the superb UVA students who have put on this wonderful conference. Yes. You know who you are, and maybe you're not in the room, but maybe you'll hear about this. It's just nice to be in a room where everything kind of seems normal, and so this is just a wonderful 2 days. So the Article II vesting clause is like the decoder ring of Article II. If you read it correctly, you can make sense of Article II, the president's relationship to the other two branches, and much of our nation's practices. If you read it wrong, you have a cramped, ahistorical, atraditional reading, and the early presidency as well as the modern presidency seems like a Frankenstein monster. Now, of course, the Article II vesting clause has long vexed politicians, judges, and ordinary people. Some people believe that the vesting clause does not vest any powers at all. It just is a reference to the other powers that are found in Article II, Sections 2 and 3. But many others, and I think including majority opinions of the Supreme Court, read it as an actual grant of power beyond those specifically vested in the rest of Article 2. Now, when I went to law school in the 1990s, the president's power over law execution was denied by many. There was an article called The President's Uncertain Power to Execute the Law. Professors Larry Lessig and Cass Sunstein wrote a piece called The President and the Administration, which was designed to show that the president had no authority over so-called administrative laws and over so-called administrative departments. You won't find the word administrative in the Constitution. Nonetheless, they thought departments like Treasury and Post Office were administrative rather than executive. They said the vesting clause was about title and number. They said it was about having one president, right? They've essentially read it as saying there shall be a president, right, with no reference to power. So in that context, a fellow you may have heard of, Steve Calabresi, and I wrote a piece in the Yale Law Journal called The Executive Power Over Law Execution. And we argued that the executive power principally is the power to execute the law. And we further argued that the president gets to direct and remove officers who are executing the law because they are executing his power. As Hamilton says, the president is the constitutional executive, as executor of the law, right? He has a constitutional warrant to execute the law. And that's how Washington treated the executive branch. He directed officers, he removed officers, and he did all this without any statutory warrant. Most statutes said nothing about direction or removal. He did it anyway. To my knowledge, no one said that what he was doing was improper. I think since Steve and I wrote that piece, this position that the president has authority over law execution has become more of a mainstream position. You can judge whether it's because of our article or something else. I'm happy to say that Kurt Bradley and Martin Flaherty endorse it, and I think Julian endorses some version of it as well. And so much of what he said today, I wholly endorse. Later, another friend of mine, Mike Ramsey, and I wrote a piece called The Executive Power Over Foreign Affairs. We claimed that in the 18th century, the executive power had a foreign affairs component, and we further claimed that the president has foreign affairs powers by virtue of the Article II vesting clause, with important exceptions and qualifications. Here are two exceptions. Congress has the power to declare war. Congress has the power to regulate foreign commerce. The president doesn't have any of those powers. The only powers he has over those two things are to propose and to veto. He can't do them on his own. And then there are certain qualifications, like the president's power to appoint ambassadors, qualified by the Senate's advice and consent function, and the president's power to make treaties, again, qualified by the Senate's advice and consent functions. With respect to what remains of the executive power over foreign affairs, serving as an organ of communication with foreign nations, directing and removing ambassadors, establishing interstitial foreign policy related to the myriad issues that the nation faces, the president decides such matters because, after all, he has the executive power. I believe that Julian disagrees with this last claim. I think he thinks it's obvious that we are wrong. How do I know this? Well, he says that our claim is demonstrably wrong. He also says it's implausible in his headings over and over again. Where I come from, them's fighting words. At the outset, let me say I'm more than puzzled by Julian's precise claim. Sometimes he says the vesting clause is an empty vessel, which sounds like it doesn't vest anything. Other times he says it's law execution. Other times he says it's also appointments. And then at the end of his article in the Pennsylvania Law Review, he says it's also a set of disaggregated powers. I should add that Professor Mortensen has also said it might include the removal power as well. And if it includes all these things, it doesn't seem like an empty vessel to me, right? It seems like it's quite full, in fact. I think it's crystal clear that the executive power is not just about law execution. We know this because there are 5 state constitutions prior to the founding that grant their executives particular powers and then go on to grant other executive powers. Right? So it can't just be one thing unless all these constitutions are guilty of some sort of incoherence. Further, when people write about the Continental Congress at the time and subsequently, including historians like Jack Rakoff, they regard the Continental Congress not as legislative but principally executive. Why? Because it had the executive power over foreign affairs. It's precisely because it has this foreign affairs component that is regarded as an executive rather than a legislative. And when the Constitution was before we the people, many people adverted to the Senate's executive role in treaties because treaty making was considered an executive power in foreign affairs. And they discussed the president's role as stewarding our foreign affairs, even though, of course, there is no provision of the Constitution that specifically authorizes the president to direct interstitially or otherwise, foreign affairs, other than, of course, the vesting clause. But the real acid test of our theory is the Constitution's early operation. President Washington made a number of decisions that are inexplicable, in my view, under Professor Mortensen's narrow reading of the vesting clause. Under the Constitution, as you well know, the president has but few foreign affairs, specific foreign affairs authorities. He has the power to, or duty to receive ambassadors, the power to appoint ambassadors with the advice and consent of the Senate, and the power to make treaties with the advice and consent of the Senate. That is it. It's not a long laundry list. But in fact, Washington did so much more, and I'll say what he did in a moment. He served as the organ of communication with foreign countries. Under the Continental Congress, Congress was the executive, and it received letters from foreign sovereigns. Foreign sovereigns continued to write letters to Congress, and Congress did a remarkable thing. They would not open those letters under the Constitution. They would hand them over to Washington. Why? Because they no longer were vested with the executive power over foreign affairs, at least in this respect. And whenever they had a message for a foreign nation, they never spoke on behalf of the United States, and they never delivered it directly. They gave it to President Washington and asked him to convey the sentiments of a particular chamber. The House would ask the president to convey their sentiments, not on behalf of the United States, but on the part of the House. And members expressly said it's because the president has an executive power over communications. He is the organ of communications. Washington also instructed American diplomats. He also fired American diplomats. He fired James Monroe, right, the future fourth president of the United States, the fifth president, sorry. And he decided, among other things, the territorial limits of the United States, what would happen if foreign powers waged war in the United States, and the stance of America towards the warring parties in Europe. None of these actions are traceable to any specific clause in Article II other than the vesting clause. And in fact, that's the clause that people at the time cited. Washington said that he controlled the content of foreign communications because he had, quote, the supreme executive authority. John Jay, the Secretary of Foreign Affairs under the Articles of Confederation, said the same thing. Here's what Thomas Jefferson said. There was a debate in the Senate, do we get to decide the destination and grade of US diplomats? And here's what Jefferson said. The transaction of business with foreign nations is executive altogether. It belongs then to the head of that department, except as to such portions of it as are specifically submitted to the Senate. It's a direct endorsement of the view that the vesting clause vests executive powers. Washington's diary says the exact same thing. As Washington put it, James Madison, along with John Jay, said that the Senate have no constitutional right to interfere with either destination or grade, their powers extending no farther than to an approbation or disapprobation of the person nominated by the president, all the rest being executive and vested in the president by the Constitution. And of course, you know, as readers of Pacificus, Hamilton agreed with all this, it would not consist with the sound rules of sound construction to consider the enumeration of particular authorities in Article 2, Sections 2 and 3, as derogating from the more comprehensive grant contained in the General Clause, further than as it may be coupled with express restrictions and qualifications. And he goes on, the enumeration ought rather, therefore, to be considered as intended by way of greater caution to specify and regulate the principal articles implied in the definition of executive power. The general doctrine, then, of our Constitution is that the executive power of the nation is vested in the president, subject only to the exceptions and qualifications contained therein. And then the great Chief Justice John Marshall agreed as a congressman. He said the president possesses the whole executive power, the sole organ of the entire nation and its external relations, and its sole representative with foreign nations. That's how he described the presidency. So there are more people that said similar things both before and after the Constitution's creation. Have I proven that they're right? I don't think so. I mean, I think you'd want to read more, and I encourage you to read Professor Mortensen's article, and I hope you read mine as well. But I think I have proven that it's not that we're not demonstrably wrong, or that we've made some implausible argument. I think you can say that we're wrong. It's happened before where I've been wrong, but I think it beggars belief to think that Washington, Jefferson, John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and the great Chief Justice, were all demonstrably wrong and made implausible arguments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Professor. Our final guest is certainly no stranger to these debates. Professor Michael Rappaport is the Hugh and Hazel Darling Foundation Professor of Law and Director for the Center of the Study of Constitutional Originalism at the University of San Diego School of Law, where he focuses on administrative law, separate issue of powers, and federalism. Along with numerous articles, he is the author, with John McGinnis, of Originalism and the Good Constitution, a frequent lecturer at universities around the world. Professor Rappaport also served in the Office of Legal Counsel, practiced appellate law in Washington, and near and dear to my heart, served as a law clerk on the Third Circuit. Professor.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me and the University of Virginia Federalist Society for putting on really what's just been a great, great conference. So thank you so much. Today I'd like to talk about the non-delegation doctrine and its relation to the thought of the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. So I'm going to get a little bit more specific here. And in my view, the original meaning of the Constitution is best understood as incorporating a version of the non-delegation doctrine. And under that version, the Constitution imposes a strict non-delegation rule in certain areas and a lenient rule in other areas. So under the strict tier, the amount of policymaking discretion allowed to the executive is either very limited or perhaps even completely eliminated. But under the lenient tier, the amount of policymaking discretion is largely unlimited. Okay, so let me start by describing how I derived the non-delegation doctrine from the constitutional text. And in my reading, the non-delegation doctrine flows from the vesting of legislative power to Congress and the executive power in the president, right? So a familiar sort of starting point. Now, the meaning of these terms, I think, is ambiguous or unclear at the time of the Constitution. Sometimes they're understood as limiting legislatures from delegating policymaking to the executive. And under this view, then, legislative power involved the exercise of policymaking discretion in enacting the law, but the executive power did not include such policymaking, right? So you couldn't give to the president or the executive policymaking. But at other times, the terms seem to be understood to permit the legislature to delegate policymaking to the executive, so seemingly the opposite. And under this view, the executive power included the power to receive a delegation. That is, to be given policymaking discretion by a statute. So if these terms are ambiguous, how do we resolve the ambiguity? And one way might be to simply decide on one meaning or the other for all areas. Right? So you either pick a strict non-delegation or a lenient non-delegation test, and you apply that across the board. But I think that's problematic and not the best way to go here. There was an historical pattern where delegation happened in some areas, but not in others. And people at the time sometimes seemed to recognize that delegation was more acceptable in some areas than in others. And so I think the better approach is to understand legislative and executive power to have differing content in different areas. How do we do this? The terms legislative and executive power should be understood as terms having a legal meaning. And legal meanings often vary depending on the context. And the content of these meanings then would differ here depending on the area where they apply. So to determine these legal meanings in different areas, the starting point is to consider the historical pattern of delegation. If legislatures regularly delegated in certain areas, then it's presumptively the case that such delegations were part of the meanings of legislative and executive power. But if legislatures typically did not delegate in an area, one would presume the legislative and executive power prohibited it. But it's not just history here, I think, that determines whether the delegation is permitted. In determining the meaning of these ambiguous terms, one would also consider constitutional structure and purpose. So to take just one example, constitutional structure supports allowing delegations in areas where the states do not have primary legislative authority, such as legislation involving the territories, foreign and military affairs, and perhaps even foreign commerce. Whereas delegation may often conflict with federalism by allowing the federal government to more easily displace state laws, this is not a concern where the states do not possess legislative authority in an area, right? You're not displacing the states because they don't have authority in that area. Well, based on a review of this history, structure, and purpose, I tentatively conclude that the lenient tier of the non-delegation doctrine applies to areas such as spending programs, the territories, the internal organization of the government, and foreign and military affairs, and some others as well. By contrast, the strict tier applies mainly to the regulation of private rights in the domestic sphere. Not only were delegations involving the regulation of private rights historically rare, but there was also a strong purpose argument for assigning this area to the strict tier. Private rights, such as the common law right of property, were considered to be among the most important rights at the framing. Thus, it would have made sense for them to ensure that regulations of these rights should have the full protections of bicameralism, presentment, and the separation of powers. Now, this two-tier theory has various advantages, I think, and one that's worth emphasizing is that most of the alleged counterexamples offered by critics of the non-delegation doctrine are outside of the strict tier. And therefore, they don't really challenge this account of the original meaning, whereas they may challenge other accounts. Now, once we've identified the areas where the strict tier applies, the next question involves, how do we distinguish between the permissible assignment of executive power and the impermissible delegation of legislative power, right? And there's two basic ways of doing this. The most common one offered by people who seek to enforce a strict non-delegation doctrine is to draw a distinction based on an 1825 Chief Justice Marshall opinion between important subjects that the legislature must address and other matters of less interest as to which the executive can't fill up the details. So under this view, this filling up the details would, if delegated to the executive, constitute executive power. It's limited. So it's not legislative. This means of distinguishing between permissible and impermissible delegation, it's a plausible take on the constitutional language, and it has the advantage of appearing to allow some examples of delegation from the founding, so some things you can understand in those terms. But it does have the disadvantage of leaving the constitutional distinction somewhat vague. While people like Justice Scalia hated such vague constitutional standards, he really hated them. They should be enforced if that's what the Constitution means, if we're sure that's what the Constitution means. But I want to point out that there's another way possibly to draw the distinction between legislative and executive power. And it's to define legislative power as the exercise of policymaking discretion as to the content of the laws. This is, after all, what legislatures do when they pass laws. What then can the executive do? The executive can interpret statutes and can make findings of fact. And in neither case is it engaged in policymaking. It's interpreting the law and finding facts. Thus, so long as the executive is restricted to making factual findings and engaging in legal interpretation, it does not exercise policymaking discretion and therefore has not been delegated legislative power. This test of impermissible delegation has a significant advantage, I think. Unlike the filling in the details test, this test is pretty determinant. There's a principled answer to what is policymaking discretion. There's also some historical support for this view. It's not merely a plausible understanding of the legislative power. It also seems to accord with James Madison's view of delegation stated in his Virginia Report on the Alien Friends Act. In criticizing the act as an unconstitutional delegation, Madison wrote that details are essential to the nature of a law, especially one that regulates private rights. So under this test, a law that allowed the executive to fill in the details as to policy would be an unconstitutional delegation. By contrast, a law such as the one from the OSHA statute, which requires OSHA to adopt the occupational standard which most adequately assures, to the extent feasible, that no employee will suffer material impairment of health, that actually might be constitutional. So long as the statute is interpreted to deny the executive policymaking discretion, it would be constitutional. So for example, if the language, to the extent feasible, was interpreted to have a definite meaning, such as technological feasibility and business feasibility, and if OSHA was required to make factual findings as to that feasibility, then there would be no delegation of policymaking discretion. Okay, so towards the end here, I'm going to come back to the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. So what can we say about the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists here? While the ratification debates do not really reveal much of a specific discussion of the non-delegation doctrine, I think we can discern some insights from their general attitudes. My sense is that the two-tier approach is consistent with the Federalists' overall view. They wanted both a workable government and one that protected people's liberties. And the two-tier view seems to allow room for each of these values. By contrast, several of the principles of the Anti-Federalists pretty clearly favored a strict non-delegation doctrine. First, the Anti-Federalists supported a strict separation of powers, criticizing the Constitution for all kinds of things, such as mixing powers, such as having the Senate participate in executive appointments. Thus, they would have been likely to be especially concerned about delegating legislative powers to the executive. Second, the Anti-Federalists supported federalism, favoring strong limits on federal power to protect against what they called a consolidation of the states. Requiring laws to go through bicameralism and presentment is an important method for limiting the federal government's power to regulate. Delegation circumvents these checks by allowing rules to be imposed by agencies alone. Finally, the Anti-Federalists supported a form of democracy with strong accountability to the voters. They often favored annual elections for the legislature and small districts so that people would know and monitor their representatives. And this also suggests they would oppose delegation because delegation moves the decisions on passing laws from representatives who stand for election to agency officials who do not. To conclude then, while I believe that both the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists would support a non-delegation doctrine, I think the Anti-Federalists especially would have been champions of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. We are going to run into some time constraints, and I am mindful that my duty as moderator is to not to keep you too long from refreshments. But I know there are questions in the audience, and I know there are questions for the panel. There's one that I'd like to ask, which I think is only due to allow the opportunity. Professor Mortensen, what does the vesting clause mean then, and how would you respond to Professor Prakash's questions?
Sure, yeah. So to some extent, my answer reveals, how I'm wrong, no. To some extent, my answer reveals that I think the enterprise that I'm involved with is fundamentally different from the enterprise that originalists who conceive of their project as generating a set of legal rules to actually be applied by courts and by, you know, lawyers in the executive branch and in the legislative branch. I am actually quite comfortable with uncertainty, where uncertainty exists. I'm actually quite comfortable with saying, look, a bunch of people said appointments are included. Not everybody, it didn't come up that often, but like, you can get there. I'm comfortable with saying, you know, the idea that the president would have the executive power, but that people could be completely insulated from his or her control and do what they want. I mean, that's a little weird. And yet, and here's the and yet uncertainty part, the actual practice of governance under these constitutions and under the relevantly analogous English practice shows that restrictions did exist, right? Like the king
is said, the Crown, I should say, is said to have, quote, the executive power by Blackstone in an Article II like listing of what the Crown's powers were. He says the king, but he means the Crown. And there were lots of people in England with important government roles who are insulated from removal, who possessed them, actually, as a property right sometimes. And does that make sense? I mean, at some level, it doesn't. But if you're approaching this as a historian who is trying to engage with immensely complex materials about a new thing, not entirely new, because there were state precedents for doing the tripartite whatnot. That's what they call it, the tripartite whatnot. But boy, this stuff was new. And so, like, of course they didn't think of anything. Any one of you who's been involved in any way with drafting a contract, let alone writing a bill, think to yourself about whether you'd expect there to be gaps and imperfections and uncertainties. Come on, of course you would, right? So for me, both as a practicing lawyer and then also especially as a historian, the way I conceive of my job, and it sounds self-aggrandizing, but I mean it, is to like to reflect on what I see. And what I see for sure is that executive power is understood as like the hand squeezing because the muscles are going. What does that mean in practice? Well, they worked out some of it, but not all of it. I could imagine it meaning nothing more than almost a negative. Wherever else the power to implement law is, it can't be subject to congressional participation. I could imagine it meaning the directive authority. Anytime the president wants to substitute his or her intentions for an executive agent, regardless of the government structure, they get to do that. I could imagine it doing lots of things. And so that's why the next phase of the project has to do as much from a research perspective with a deep dive in the practice of the early republic as with, you know, new original research beyond what I've already done. I think I wandered a little bit, but that's what I come back to. So in some respects, right, as between, does the executive power include, on the list of things from complete control down to removal, directive power, supervisory power, loose supervisory power, a removal power? I can see arguments for all those different things. They didn't talk about it. But what it clearly doesn't do is contain any, and I want to revert back to the grammar, competences. No competences over subject matters. It has to do with powers. Remember, competences. The sewers, policing, treaties, the areas of governance that must be done. I'm running out of water. My mouth is drying up. Sorry. And then powers. The tripartite structure by which we can say of a city, this very spot where we are now is a city. It has complete legislative, judicial, and executive powers. This city plainly did not have the treaty power. So what does he mean? What does Oliver Ellsworth, right, super significant Federalist, mean by saying that? What he's saying is it can implement all the things that it wants to. He's not making a claim about foreign affairs powers. So at some level, I plead guilty, I guess, to not having a fully worked out theory about what I would write if I was an originalist judge, not committed to a theory and different to democracy. I haven't done that work, but what I've tried to do is to reflect what the historical record actually says. And for the power to be an empty vessel means that there is a power in the sequence of functions of government rather than that it's a reference to some subject matter area of governance. At least that's what I claim.
Professor Maska?
Well, I was just gonna, maybe this is too long of a discussion to handle here, but I just wanted to say, I mean, if you're talking at least on the removal point about the king and examples of removal protection and it being a property right, would that not possibly be an explanation as to why the executive power actually could include supervisory and direction and removal power, and here in the States present itself early on without tenure protections, but present itself in England differently because you would have the executive power limited by the property right, whereas maybe that would not exist here in our system because of other distinctions. And then the other question, and this is probably more for the other panelists and you to duke out, but it does, I mean, Professor McConnell talks about this in his book as well. I mean, if the executive power really is only law execution, it does appear that there are powers that are happening today, like when foreign affairs and national security, that then are missing from the Constitution if they don't also inhere in the executive power itself, it's hard to have like a coherent view of where we get all the powers that are they being exercised. And then the final thing I was going to just say is sort of a couple of practical, like bringing it back to modern thought on the supervision power with the executive power. I think actually the Supreme Court, of course, is moving more to a view that includes the removal power within the vesting clause. But also, I think just in 2021, is also starting to perhaps understand the supervision power within the vesting clause to also include direction on the front end in the Arthrex opinion. So that's an interesting move. And then the final thing is, I think it is, we should really be working hard on all of these debates about whether the executive power itself inherently includes foreign affairs power, national security power. As a practical matter, coming fairly recently from the executive branch, I mean, I do think a lot of the work of modern practice is going to be figuring out for Congress, if the courts aren't going to step in, what the appropriate amount of power is to delegate. Because the debate in the, I mean, with all the vast executive power being exercised, it's really all happening now in the part that we all up here agree the president has, which is carrying out law. Like the Trump administration, I mean, maybe they talk some about treaty administration, military strikes, but even there, like, they were figuring out what their statutory authority was. Like the authorization of use of military force was relied on for preliminary strikes in 2021. And emergency power, like the pandemic, the Biden administration, all the recent administrations, they're not sitting around like a Youngstown debate. What is our inherent executive power in the Constitution? Congress has given vast powers at the border and everywhere else, possibly, or at least vague statutory terms that are being, so whatever your view of the executive power, it actually would not, in a daily basis, change anything if you still continue to have the amount of delegation in a statutory sense going to the executive as we have today, because so much is being shoveled in there. So that, I guess, makes Professor Rappaport's research all the more relevant and important.
Why don't we turn to your questions with some of the time that we have remaining? Some microphones coming around. And why don't we start with the fifth panelist who is participating today?
I have a question primarily for Cy. Is your view of executive power, that such as over foreign affairs, that it is, that it trumps any congressional power, or is it defeasible, that is, President acts first, but if Congress does something within its power that contradicts it, Congress wins? And maybe the concrete way to put this is, you described the Jefferson position having to do with whether the Senate could direct where foreign affairs ministers would go. Suppose Congress as a whole, rather than the Senate, said, well, we're going to send somebody of ambassadorial rank to The Hague, pursuant to the Congress's power to establish offices. Who wins, the president or Congress?
That's a great question, Michael. I think the first thing that's telling is that the president is creating offices, ambassadors and ministers, plenipotentiary on his own. This is the one set of offices that the president's creating on his own. All the other offices in the executive branch are created by statute. That itself, to me, is telling about the scope of the executive power, because it's not happening anywhere else. I'd further say, I think it was entirely plausible to suppose that they were wrong to believe that the president could create these offices, right? So my claim isn't that President Washington did nothing wrong, but each of these examples is meant to show that they clearly thought he had foreign affairs powers beyond the ones specified in Article 2, Sections 2 and 3. And then as to your particular question, as you know, Madison and Hamilton disagreed about whether there could be overlap in foreign affairs powers. Madison denied it as Helvidius. He said it'd be a terrible system if both branches had power over something. Whereas Hamilton was more open to the idea that there could be overlap. And the piece I wrote with Ramsey took the position that there was no overlap. But I think upon reflection, I think it's quite possible that there is overlap. And when there is overlap, I do believe that Congress wins. Not because it's obvious from the Constitution. It does say that laws are the supreme law of the land. But the Supremacy Clause is principally about federalism and not about the separation of powers. Nonetheless, I think if President Washington believes he has authority and that Congress also has authority, I think he would conclude as a matter of constitutional structure that Congress's statute wins. The areas where there is overlap is unclear, but in with respect to the proclamation that Washington issued, Hamilton expressly said that both the Congress and the President could declare neutrality, and that if Congress declared war, we would be at war.
In the back.
I think my question might have been answered to some extent here with Professor McConnell's question, but to Professor Prakash. So to give a concrete example of when Congress and the President butt heads on issues of foreign affair powers, Zita Kofsky v. Kerry, Congress says they can recognize a sovereign power. President disagrees, says that's well within my scope. How are we as originalists, how ought we decide those kinds of conflicts?
I mean, you've clearly read the opinion. Mike Ramsey and I took the position that the President has a power of recognition. I subsequently came to the conclusion that there are at least some places where Congress has to have the power of recognition. So if you go back to the Revolutionary War, once France recognized the United States, Great Britain took that as a declaration of war against Great Britain. Because in the 18th century, if you recognized rebels and aided them, you were also essentially declaring war against the mother country. So I think, I don't think that the President, you know, can decide to, you know, aid rebels or recognize rebels or recognize the a rebel government or in a Civil War context without running afoul of Congress's power to declare war. And there are other examples of this. John Quincy Adams gives an example of this as well later on in the 19th century, that even though the President has the power of recognition, there's certain recognition acts he cannot take because it would violate Congress's power to declare war. So I think the majority opinion is right, but of course the majority opinion doesn't endorse the vesting clause thesis. They use other clauses to reach that result. And then they further claim that Congress doesn't have any authority. I'm not sure it's obvious from the text that Congress doesn't have any authority. I think there are many textual hooks, but I do believe the practice mostly conforms to what the majority described.
Down here in the front.
I had a question for Professor Rappaport. So talking about your OSHA example, saying the extent feasible, it's okay as long, it's not wouldn't be non-delegation, run afoul of the non-delegation doctrine as long as it's got a specific meaning. I was wondering under that theory, under your second theory, who would determine the specific meaning? And would it be kind of like a reverse of Chevron step one? Like if it's a vague statute, then it violates non-delegation.
Well, and so there's two questions here you have to think about. So the first is, are we giving to the executive policymaking? The second question is, who gets, you know, is there judicial review? And if there is judicial review, to what extent is it is operating? I think those are actually two different questions. And if the executive is simply doing legal interpretation and factual findings, even if there's no judicial review, assuming that's okay, then that's not a delegation. Now, it may be problematic in the sense that there's no supervision, there's no check, or no normal sort of judicial review check, but there wouldn't be, the problem wouldn't be that there's a delegation of power there. The separate question is, you know, do we have judicial review or not? And there could be and there could not be. And you could even imagine, I suppose, deferential kinds of judicial review. And maybe those are constitutional, maybe they're not.
This is to what you were talking about, Professor Mortensen. I'm curious, you know, obviously, we don't have a king, but the executive power has undeniably grown significantly since the Constitutional Convention. You know, how much were the anti-federalist fears well-founded? And from an originalist perspective, can their thoughts be used to trim and tamper down the current state of the executive power?
am I allowed to be Socratic and flip this back on you? I think so. I mean, one of the, I don't have my all my quotes in front of me, but one of the things I think is most striking, one of the things that really leapt out to me as the grammar of the founding started to come into view, as I read a whole bunch of stuff, was a comment from Madison about the scope of presidential power being kind of not the dark horse, but the sort of, in any event, the thing that actually, notwithstanding everything the Federalists had said, could become a problem unless you checked Congress. And it takes a second maybe to see why that, he has a long discussion of this, why that's so significant. He's saying that what Congress does pursuant to its valid legislative competences is going to define the scope, absent some specific textual, you know, provisions in Article 2, what the president can do. And so this is one of the reasons, connecting the separation of powers to federalism, that he wants to lean in, especially as the 90s go on, to a vision that's more constrained. Yes, he's worried about Congress as such. Yes, he's worried about federalism. But he's also worried over the long run about a structure in which the more power we give Congress, the more power is going to be pushed off to the president. So from my own personal perspective, is I have a lot of hesitations about a lot of the delegations that are on the statute books today. And I think that the fears of those who thought that we're looking at a massive centralization of power along administrative, you know, crown lines, or, I mean, look around us, right? I mean, it's, Professor Mascott talked about Trump relying on the AOMF. I mean, Obama did the same thing. I mean, the office has a way of leading its occupant to like squeeze every possible bit of power from everywhere it can. And boy, there's a lot of flex across a lot of different issue areas where that power exists, which is a long-winded way of saying, yes, for me the solution is democratic politics. And either it works or it doesn't. And we either win with it or we lose with it. It's not judges sitting on the bench, all due respect. I'm sure this would never happen in your shoes, and drawing like highly contestable conclusions from really abstract language to like impose a better vision of governance. That to me is not the right role. It's not the right solution to what I think is a real problem.
Can I just add one thing? To be clear, I was actually, and just maybe this was clear in my remarks, I was actually not saying that's improper. I was, because the executive branch, from the executive branch standpoint, they are to, so I agree with what you're saying, and saying, of course, within the executive branch, attorneys have to figure out what the power is that's been given to the president. So really, to the extent we're concerned about this, Congress has to enact narrower or more precise laws that don't give so much power if it's concerned about the discretion or of the executive. The executive, of course, is trying to figure out what can be done lawfully to faithfully execute those broad laws that the executive's been given. And then we have to think about our theory of judicial review. How much, to what extent, is there a constitutional problem with this, as Professor Rappaport's raising? And at that point, obviously, well, the executive then, I would think, if he's faithfully executing, may not carry it out if it's unconsciously broad delegation, or the courts would step in. So for this to work properly, I think, and for whatever we're concerned about to be peeled back, other institutions have to step up. It's not, you know, all rising or falling on whether the executive's doing something wrong or right. Everybody has to faithfully labor to interpret and carry out their proper constitutional role.
We have time for one last question.
Professor Mortensen, I want to ask about the hand and brain analogy a little bit. There was about 1 month between Washington taking office and Congress passing the first law. If there had been a significant emergency during that time, would Washington have had much power to deal with it, or would he have been essentially paralyzed by the lack of a signal from the brain?
This is great, because it's like the thing that I'm most excited about in my research right now is tracing how emergencies were handled and talked about over the course of the 18th century in particular. There turns out to have been a surprisingly robust, and this too I'm not necessarily sure I'm such a big fan of, but a surprisingly robust tradition of executive actors in the broadest sense just doing what they needed to, and then going to the legislative branch for retrospective sanction or for indemnity. This is fascinating. I mean, and there's not much time. Read about the 19, I'm doing it again. I exist so much in the 18th century, I always start reading the 9. Read about the corn crisis of, I think, 1766. There's a guy in a port, I forget which one sitting here right now, in England, who, notwithstanding a statute on the books that tells you here's how you handle when there's a corn shortage, which is to say a wheat shortage, this is the only thing. He goes beyond that. And the set of questions that emerge from that is, as the Parliament debates whether or not to indemnify him, map onto the Youngstown question actually like remarkably well. And so my answer is, violate and ratify, almost certainly, would have been what would have happened. Would arguments have emerged as they did in other respects for the legality of what he would have done? I bet you turn to the commander-in-chief clause, maybe with sufficiently foresightful Hamilton, turn to the executive power clause. But they were aware of the risks of creating officers that were limited to their powers in a very stark way. And one of the ways there was flex was a comfort level with violating the law that kind of creeps me out, but that they were more comfortable with, and they relied on the downstream political process to fix it.
Yeah. So. The only thing I want to say is I'm also struck by that tradition, and I know Sai has looked into it as well. The interesting thing about it is just think about how different that understanding of how we deal with emergencies is with our world today. So the officer has got to put himself at risk, and he's going to be liable unless after the fact the legislature comes in and gives him immunity. Not what we have today, which is like, oh yeah, we'll violate whatever, and as long as it's not so clearly the case, we're immune. That's a very different understanding of the structure of incentives.
Yeah, I want to agree with what Julian and Mike said. If you look at the Revolutionary War, what you find is a series of statutes at the state and national level delegating temporary authority. Often geographically constrained to governors and the commander-in-chief. And then when those grants expired, the emergency authority went away and would have to do with trying people in military courts for various offenses like not taking continental currency, things that you might think should be tried in ordinary courts being tried in military courts. So I think Julian's absolutely right. There was no executive power of emergency in America, and what they would do is if it was push came to shove, they would act illegally and then ask to be forgiven, and then they would be forgiven if it was truly an emergency. And then Mike's further right that really changes your incentives, right? Because you're worried that they might not indemnify you, and then you're going to be in trouble. But that is the structure of how states and the Continental Congress dealt with the emergencies that were prevalent during the Revolutionary War.
I want to thank all of the panelists for this most extraordinary. And our thanks as well again to the chapter here at the University of Virginia for this wonderful weekend. Thank you all.